Welcome to The Riff, where writer and investor Bern Hobart and I discuss the major inflection points caused by technological change. Our weekly conversation covers the obvious and not so obvious ways in which markets and businesses will adapt as a result. Let's jump right in.
Let's get into it. You've written some really interesting things the past week or so. Let's start with the piece on Tiger. Why don't you talk about what you unpack there?
Yeah, sure. So as I understand the backstory here, there's a book, Private Equity. It's a memoir. It's called Private Equity, a memoir, by someone named Carrie Sun. And my understanding, vaguely from just things I've read online, is that originally she was going to write the book and use real names, talk about real people, et cetera. And then at the last minute decided, with the help of the attorneys of the people who was writing about, decided, okay, well, I'll actually disguise who I'm writing about. But it's just really, really clear from the context. And apparently she used to have a LinkedIn and it's now gone or something. Like, people know where she worked and that she worked at Tiger Global, and that clearly the company being described as Tiger Global. And it was an interesting book. So it is a memoir about being a young professional in New York. And, some of it is very memoir-y stuff about having a toxic relationship with a fiance and having an eating disorder and things like that. But, it is also about being an assistant to a investment firm. They actually do not want to call themselves a hedge fund that had a really big impact. And so I thought there were like two big categories of value from the book, one of which was that it's neat to get this look at what things are like inside of a company like that. So Tiger Global has a fairly small investment team considering their assets under management. They work really hard. People do tend to stay there for a long time. So there's just business books need there to be someone who actually knows what's going on and has a reason to talk. And if everyone's busy making money, then no one's quitting, then everyone who knows what was going on is not actually going to say that much, for not going to publish that much, not going to talk to a journalist or whatever. So yeah, you end up getting a much better look at companies that were just a total disaster. In this case, people read some parts of the book as being very negative about Tiger. And like, certainly it sounds like an environment that is not for everyone, just like ruthlessly fast paced. It's supposed to be apolitical, but you always know that a company has an office politics problem when they say that we don't play politics at the office. It had some negative things, but also like it seemed to be a really positive book on just that they do in fact work really hard. They did actually make a lot of money because they were very good stock pickers. Obviously got walloped in 2022, but over longer periods, like they did a good job. So it was like, it was useful to get this look at, okay, what do you actually have? Like, what kind of organization do you have to have? What kind of day-to-day job has to exist in order to have this firm that can scale up massively and be writing like multiple checks per week at its peak and investing in everything and doing these, lightning fast due diligence processes and all that stuff? Like, where did that come from? That's really useful. But I think the other interesting thing about the book is that assistants do actually make the world go round. So she wrote, she was an assistant. She actually did some investment research at the firm, and she had a background that was more on the investment side, but she was an assistant. And the people who get profiled in big magazines and, get profiled online or whatever for their business acumen, like, those people generally don't manage their own calendars. They are generally not the person who is deciding like what would be a thoughtful gift for the 500 people who I vaguely know but do not actually have like, a gift in mind for. Like, someone has to handle that stuff for them. And an assistant has to be, extremely conscientious, and also has to be, able to triage, like has to be smart enough that if that morning there are, 2,000 unread emails, it's her job to figure out which of these emails needs to be in front of the boss right now so that he can start making calls, like what parts of the calendar need to get shuffled around, all that stuff. Like, they do some really valuable work. Some of them do get paid quite well, but it's actually kind of tricky to pay them an amount that really reflects their economic value. And what I think this actually ends up being a really interesting search problem. So if you are looking for an assistant, let's say you are someone who, you know, in a good year makes literally $1 billion. So the opportunity cost of something like you missed a meeting, or, you know, you didn't keep on top of something, or you saw an email the next day instead of the day when you would have really wanted to react to it, like, that cost is insanely high. Like, if you could be guaranteed to get the ideal assistant, and the only problem is you have to pay them, I don't know, $20 million a year, like, you would take it if that were the guarantee. But actually, if someone is an assistant, they are working with you. They're working with a specific person. So there has to be this very, very direct match between their personality and the boss's personality. In some cases, you want two people who are very similar. On other axes, you want people who are completely opposites. And so you have to figure out who is the right fit. And that means you have to interview someone in great depth. Like, obviously, this is the kind of thing where they don't have the first round interview. It's not like the first person you talk to is Chase Coleman, and then later on, you know, you talk to the head of HR or something. No, like, they want to backload that part of the interview as much as possible and do a lot of research in advance to make sure this is the right person. But ultimately, the prospective assistant has to spend some time with the boss. And so that limits the number of people it's actually feasible to interview. And it also means that, yeah, if you find the right person, you should really throw money at them. Like, they should feel like this is a much better pay than they would ever get for a similar kind of job. But at the same time, they are extremely underpaid relative to how much value they can actually create. So I thought that was interesting. And it's like, if someone does that job extremely well, they are totally invisible. Like, no, you know, it's, if someone, no one ever gets complimented on that their assistant did a really, you know, is really, really great, because the assistant who does a really good job, it's just, this person is invisibly 10% more competent than they otherwise would be. So someone who writes about the day-to-day life of this, you know, invisible, if it's done well, job is just generally valuable. Like, the economy is made up of lots of different people doing lots of different things. Some of those things are really, really obvious, and, you know, everyone can have a theory about them. So, you know, if you want to theorize about the economics of celebrity, like, everyone knows who those celebrities are. Everyone has a view on why they're popular, why they're not. Everyone complains about prices of the same events and things, and everyone complains about the same, you know, streaming monetization numbers being terrible or whatever. So, like, we all see it and we all can talk about it. But then I have no idea what, you know, what life is like for a scrap metal broker or something like that. But they do have, you know, this meaningful contribution to the economy. Like, we would absolutely notice if suddenly it were impossible to cost effectively get scrap metal to the people who actually want to use it. So I like finding in-depth write-ups of these kind of obscure jobs. I think that they are just very valuable for, you know, adding one piece to the economic puzzle, but also telling you that the puzzle has a whole lot of missing pieces, and sometimes you don't even know what's missing from your model.
Yeah, it's fascinating. To your point on executive assistants, a lot of CEOs have started to get chief of staffs now, which to me is a way of just getting a higher competent person. And what they end up having their chief of staffs do is, in some ways, try to replace them in more and more of the activity, or act on their behalf. Whereas an EA can do that on a scheduling front or on certain operational sides, a chief of staff in theory can do that across the board. But of course, no individual person can replace you at a whole level. So you can almost imagine having multiple people, some with different axes, but because they're able to act as the CEO, they have like more authority, more credibility. They can, you know, just get things done in a higher way. And it serves as a way to just expand the capabilities of the CEO in ways that would be different if they were just, you know, other employees at the company.
Yeah, it does feel like there are two tracks for the main assistant to someone who's, you know, running a big company, making a lot of money. So one track is that you're the executive assistant, but you end up also running their personal life. Like, a lot of people who get very wealthy, one of the reasons that they are as wealthy as they are is that, given the opportunity to trade off between personal stuff and business stuff, they will always choose whatever's best for the business, or they'll default to choosing what's best for the business stuff. But that often means that there's just a lot of complexity in their personal affairs, and just what they need done, and, you know, what logistics are like. So one thing that Carrie mentions in this book is that in all of her time working at Tiger Global, Chase Coleman was never interrupted by something involving his kids during the workday. So there's always someone taking care of that. And, you know, the executive assistant, it's not a nanny track job, but it is definitely a nanny coordinator track job of, like, the kids are, you know, they're at their swim practice and they need to get to the birthday party, but the driver was out sick today. And so someone needs to figure out how the kids get from point A to point B. That ends up falling in the executive assistant's lap, and then it has to get done. But then I think the other track is more of a chief operating officer track kind of role, where it's sort of like the CEO realizes 24 hours in a day, just like everybody else, and definitely has more than 24 hours worth of tasks to do. So starts taking the tasks that are just most cleanly defined, such that you can just write a memo and, you know, a third party could look at someone's output on this work and say, yes, they did a good job. And then depending on how the chief of staff executes that, they can end up doing more and more demanding projects. There's a really interesting rule that Amazon has that D.E. Shaw previously had, which I think is where they got it, where it's someone who is like the D.E. Shaw role was sort of like troubleshoot IT stuff and then just do all sorts of miscellaneous projects. But it was troubleshoot IT stuff for David Shaw, who's a great computer scientist who'd been doing interesting work on parallelizing problems for a very long time. So it's probably much more interesting kind of technology fixer type problems. But really the broad rule was just find the stuff that is not worth the CEO's time to figure out whether or not it's worth the CEO's time, basically. And if you have someone who can at least do that filter for you, that of all of the diversions that you could spend an hour or two on, here's the one of today's that is actually probably worth the hour or two. Like that is really valuable. And that just naturally can flow to, okay, you service this as an interesting opportunity to go after, but I still don't have time to go after it, but maybe you should. And so those roles, they do tend to switch from more admin-y to more operational over time. But there's also, again, because of the fact that this is this one-to-one relationship of you're helping make one person more effective, the richer they are, the weirder they are on at least some dimension. Like there has to be a reason that this person is paid as well as they're paid. And so the role does have to grow into whatever that person's idiosyncrasies are. So it does, like, these roles, they become very hard to generalize about, very hard to characterize. Like some assistants, the job is close to make sure no one ever interrupts this person. And then for other people, it's like structure a continuous flow of useful interruptions. And there's like, both of those are actually part of the job. So the private equity has this wonderful scene where our protagonist is extremely nervous because it's the first time that she has to go like interrupt a meeting to hand her boss a note. And it's like, that's gotta be stressful. You know, if you interrupt the wrong meeting at the wrong time with a note that actually could have waited, and that's really bad. On the other hand, if you stand there just feeling nervous while time is elapsing and something very pressing is happening and the relevant parties are not informed, like that's also a problem. So, you could see why a job like this would be extremely high stress and you'd have to actually pay someone quite a lot of money to put up with it.
Hey everybody, Eric here with a word from our sponsors. The tech world turns to the Brave browser for its unbeatable privacy protections. But did you know that Brave also has a private ad platform? Brave Ads offers first-party targeting, and it's been cookie-less since day one, so you can relax while third-party tracking cookies disappear from the web. Today, millions of people turn to ad blockers to avoid being tracked and pestered online. But Brave's new ad model aligns incentives for users and advertisers. Users earn rewards for viewing ads, which they can save, spend, or pass along to their favorite creators. And advertisers score points for respecting user privacy, generating ROI without invasive tracking. So whether it's high-impact announcements on the new tab page or keyword-targeted ads in Brave Search, Brave offers diverse, private, future-proof ad formats for all your business goals. Join the future of advertising at brave.com/ads. Mention MOZ when signing up for a 25% discount on your first campaign.
The other thing that's interesting about Tiger that you write about is how they scaled the ability to do deals without scaling the team. And, you know, that's mm-hmm. a contrast to someone like Andreessen Horowitz, who has scaled their ability to do deals by having 500 people on staff. And so it's interesting to think about those different approaches. And then also, I guess my take, though, maybe you'd agree with this, is that the Tiger strategy only really made the Tiger strategy of paying up for these companies and thus being the founder favorite, i.e. pay up, no sort of diligence, basically, or very little diligence on the founder's end, and then very little sort of governance. So it's sort of giving the founder, you know, exactly what they want, for some founders, for being as founder friendly as possible. That only works in a works in terms of produces returns in an environment where these companies are being undervalued, such that paying up still makes sense. And it turns out maybe these companies actually weren't undervalued. Maybe they were overvalued. And so maybe it didn't make sense.
I think that is definitely part of, like, at one level, what Tiger's decision to start just raising absolutely massive funds, investing in just about everything that was growing fast. Like, what was impressive about that at one level was they were taking seriously the continuous critique of VCs, which is VCs only want to invest in something that is differentiated and unique and, you know, can't be replicated anywhere else. And they all say this, and, you know, some huge fraction of all venture capital is invested within, you know, a 10-minute walk of somewhere in Menlo Park. So, like, and then, you know, they often have very similar backgrounds, and they tend to jump into the same hot sectors at the same time. So, you know, when the 20th person who just got really, really interested in AI in the last 18 months tells an AI company that it needs to be more differentiated, and it needs to do something no one else can do, like, it does get kind of old. So Tiger took seriously this idea that you have people who are looking for something differentiated, and they are actually in a commodity business that doesn't have great economies of scale. And Tiger tried to expand those economies of scale. And, you know, I guess, you know, rehashing the entire question of, like, how disastrous was this strategy, and, you know, will we actually know more in 10 years, or can we definitively say that, no, if you deploy that much money that fast in the middle of just this face ripping rally in tech, that you will obviously lose a lot. And, like, I think it'll actually really depend. There was the famous Kleiner Perkins clean tech fund that was, like, this huge hit to their reputation, put a lot of money into a lot of businesses that just did not work. Like, they were a more capital intensive way to produce a lower margin substitute for things that already existed. And that happened again and again and again. But then it turned out the fund actually, I believe, actually did quite well, because one of their investments was Beyond Meat, and then Beyond Meat went public. And so for that, when Beyond Meat was still a hot stock, technically the Kleiner Perkins Sustainability Whatever Fund was actually an extremely good performer because of that one deal. And Tiger, you know, so many companies were founded in 2020 and 2021, and generational companies have to get founded at some point. So I think it's entirely possible that they will end up with a handful of portfolio companies that completely justify, like, you know, that largely justify their splurge. It may not happen. It'll actually be an interesting test of just the argument that if you have a power law distribution of returns, your expected mean actually goes up as you make more investments. So you should realistically, like, choose a quality threshold such that you believe you're getting power law returns, and then buy every single thing that hits that threshold. So in some ways, like, they were taking very sophisticated reasoning about the nature of venture investing very seriously. They were taking a critique of that very seriously. I also think the low headcount thing is really interesting if you think about the idea that the value that an investment analyst provides is often in connecting different ideas that don't seem to be completely related. So it's often like you're looking at company X, you have this big question about their margins. As you're exploring that question, you realize the margins are bad because one of their suppliers has a lot of pricing power. You realize that supplier is publicly traded and the stock price does not reflect all that pricing power. So you end up going from rejecting one opportunity to investing in another. But if you don't happen to be following that supplier very closely, if you don't have the mental bandwidth to do that, then you miss that opportunity and you've wasted the effort that you spent on looking into the margin situation. And one way to increase the number of connections is you take the same amount of research and have it done by fewer people who are working longer hours. So you do have this trade-off where they are underslept relative to how they otherwise would be. And you also have the trade-off of some people want to work a relaxing 14-hour a day job and they just can't handle the 16 or 18-hour a day pace. And so they choose, you know, some calmer more laid back hedge fund instead. But the people you do get, they are looking at more companies and looking at more information than just about anybody else. And so they, if there is some really off the wall idea where you have to connect a bunch of different things, but you do find this unique, interesting opportunity, then it's likely to be found by a team like that. And it does look like what Tiger tried to do was they spent a lot of money on outside consultants doing diligence on deals. And there is, you know, investors sometimes wonder, like, I think they were not spending much time wondering this in 2021, but like in 2022, 2023, when they're looking at their returns, one of their questions is like, why are you an investment research firm that is like your specialty, and yet your biggest cost line item other than your employee bonuses is paying somebody else to do the research for you? But I think when you do some research processes, you can actually break it down into the kinds of things that you will actually learn a lot from, and then the kinds of things where you just have to put in the reps and you will learn these object level things that don't apply anywhere else. So something like looking into the background of the management team, you know, that is part of the diligence process at many firms, not all, but at many firms, you know, they at least want to Google this person and see if they have any felonies or whatever. And, but you're generally not going to learn something from doing one background research thing that you can actually apply in other ones that's going to give you these unique generalizable insights. No, you usually just learn either there's no blemish on their record, or they did something, you know, something mildly bad that you, it's good to know, but not going to change your decision. Or, you know, maybe you learn that actually they were, you know, they did something really amazing that they just did not actually mention before. But you, like that kind of thing, I think it's safer to outsource. And then the kinds of things where you are actually building up a mental model, you're understanding connections between different companies better, you're doing something in one industry that could apply to some other industry. I think doing that in-house is really valuable. And in fact, if you look at where Tiger made their money, their early track record, a lot of it was you find a company that has done well with some model in America, you find another market where nobody's doing that. And then as soon as somebody starts doing it, you invest in them. So you understand how the Expedia model works in the United States. You find a company like Make My Trip in India. Was it India or China? Anyway, you find it in an emerging market, and you basically just do the math on, okay, how fast are people going online in this market? How fast is travel spend happening in this market? Do they have more pricing power because it's a more fragmented market for airlines and hotels? And then, you know, you model it out and you realize this company is too cheap. Or you can even do that with established companies, where you actually break the company into different hypothetical segments and ask, what would these be worth as standalone public companies? So you you take Amazon and you say, okay, we have this e-commerce company with integrated logistics. We also have this cloud computing company. What would the cloud company be worth on its own? What would this integrated e-com logistics type company be worth? And, you know, how would investors think about these differently? If you broke this company up in such a way that all of its most valuable stuff was valued on a standalone basis, how would the maximally optimistic person in that space value the company? And sometimes you find that some companies are just trading at this massive discount because people have sort of rounded it up to, you know, American company in a fairly mature market, and they're not seeing that it's actually growing faster overseas, and they're not seeing that it has this other component of the business that is losing money now, but has much better incremental margins in the core business. And so you can make a lot of money that way, but to do that kind of analogy-driven investing, you need a very large library of analogies. So you don't want your China internet analyst to only be looking at Chinese internet companies, your American internet analyst only look at American companies. If you have them as the same person, then you don't have to wait for some lucky conversation where someone is like, how many dollars per user per year in revenue does this company get? And the answer is like, well, they get 3 cents per user per year. And someone's like, well, that can't be right. Like, even if you adjust for the GDP difference, like, surely the number has to go up from there. Like, if it's all in the same person's head, then someone can look at, you know, they can look at Baidu and say, okay, this is Google in 2001. Like, they haven't figured out anything except that they dominate the search business and they're growing faster than anybody else. But we know what search economics will look like over time. So I think that is just, it is a testament to the value of having more information in fewer heads. It is obviously something that can't apply that broadly. Just not all of us want to work that hard. Not all of us want to spend all of our time on investment research. But for people who just really, really do want to be excellent, I think their long-term track record is a testament to how far hard work can actually get you. And then their more recent track record is a testament to the fact that if you run a high risk business model, you swing for fences, and then you decide you're going to up the risk, even though you're in a giant bull market, like that can be the wrong decision, the wrong timing. And sometimes you can just deploy enough capital at unfavorable enough valuations that no amount of hard work is actually going to make up for that overhang.
Yeah. It's fascinating as I think about, you know, how to transform or evolve Turpentine from not just a media business, but also a knowledge and insights and data business that primarily sells to investors. It's interesting to think about, you know, what are the areas which investors should outsource their knowledge versus make sure they have it in-house or outsource even their knowledge retrieval. So one of the ideas I thought that could be, you know, a good business, you kind of alluded to it, is sort of management checks references as a business. Mm-hmm. Where you, you know, firms pay you to reference management teams. You then build up this data set. You get paid to build up this data set, which is data on management teams that isn't on the, you know, isn't public, isn't legible. You have proprietary access to it. It compounds. And so it's interesting to think, like, where are there other, you know, areas where you could build this compounding sort of data set? Tegas is an example of a company that's done it very well that we're inspired by. Mm-hmm. And then that also maybe segues also to, you've written about sort of in capital gains, alternative, data, sort of products and companies and sort of the opportunities and challenges, there. And any reactions to that? Let's get into your unpacking that.
Yeah. Like I think that thinking about what parts of the process are basically they are a commodity to the funds that need the research done, but they can actually be something proprietary branded. You know, people have a preference. You know, people don't like using the Bloomberg terminal necessarily. They like having a Bloomberg terminal, and even though the data, like some of the data is proprietary to Bloomberg, but some of it is pretty much commoditized, but if it's all in the same bundle, it all has the same integrations, and it's all, you know, in line and available to you when you're chatting. And, you know, if you reference an asset, then Bloomberg can helpfully populate a window with some data on where that's trading and where it has, the chart, the fundamentals, et cetera. Like that stuff, it can be valuable. It does seem like in financial data, there is a pretty fast cycle of something is, you know, no one's ever heard of it, and then one person's doing it and they're making a lot of money, and then a lot of people are doing it and they're making some money, but now all the trades that are powered by this are getting very, very crowded, and so it's time to move on to the next thing. And, you know, after a while, there's often still alpha in signals that went through a boom and bust cycle. It's just, it stabilizes at less alpha. And so you still have to do it. You won't make as much money as you were before. On the other hand, you often just get cheaper access to whatever that data set was, because more people are using it and there are more providers of the actual data or similar data. And I think, yeah, the alt data space, it's been a really interesting one to watch. So I used to work in that space, like analyzing anonymized consumer spending data and looking at web scraping data and just trying to figure out what's going on with the business. It has gone through this cycle where initially you could make a lot of money just looking at directional indicators of, is the business growing faster or slower than expected? That was a really easy way to make money. And I think none of us truly appreciated how blessed we were that we had, you know, slightly higher than 50-50 odds of correctly calling a quarter. And if you can do that at scale, you can do very well. But once you have a lot of people who are looking at the same data, you can have a case where the market price fully reflects whatever the credit card spending data is showing. And every day when there's a new update, the price, you know, twitches around a little bit based on that. But then the share price is not going to respond to things like changes in margins or changes in management's future expectations until those get announced. So you would often end up with people who are very crowded trades where if you were right, you made a little bit of money. And if you were wrong, you lost a ton of money because you and everyone else was rushing for the exits at exactly the same time. So one of the transitions that's occurred since then is that people are increasingly using alternative data to get a better understanding of how a business actually works. And they're comparing companies to peers and figuring out what it is that, you know, what is unique about this company, and how its margins, how its long-term unit economics compare to those of its competitors. And when you do that, like, you're not making a bet on any given quarter. You are actually making a bet on the long-term evolution of the business. But for some companies, that is really the bet that you're underwriting when you buy the stock. So if you look at something like DoorDash, like, the entirety of your DoorDash thesis has to come down to what fraction of, like, what does it cost to get a new customer, and what fraction of those customers are going to keep ordering after they stop getting the discounts and, you know, waived delivery fees and all that. Like, who's going to develop a DoorDashing habit? And then what is the gross margin to DoorDash from every incremental burrito delivered? And once you can answer all of those questions, then you have a really good sense of what the business looks like long term. You have a good sense of, okay, when they spend X on marketing, are they actually getting good value for that? And then you can even start to underwrite things like, okay, let's say they do something, let's say they build a chatbot, and the chatbot is, you know, you talk to it about what you're hungry for, and it knows everything you've ordered. It probably knows if you gave meals a thumbs up or thumbs down. It knows what people with similar tastes also order from other places. So if they build a chatbot, you actually have a better sense of, okay, they spent, you know, $50 million on this, you know, world's most elaborate appetizer selection chatbot, but it does look like the lift from that is enough that it totally justifies the cost. So doing that does mean making longer term investments. It means that you are still exposed to just the quarter to quarter fluctuations, how a business is doing. But it also means that you actually understand the company better than just about anyone who's not at the company. And in some cases, depending on what data you're collecting and what stage of company you're looking at, you can actually get to the point where you understand, at least you understand how much better a company is than its competitors, better than the people at the company do. Because if you can look at, you know, retention for all delivery companies, and you find that there's one delivery company that's just a massive outlier, they may not know that they're a massive outlier. They just know delivery is a really tough business. It's operationally intensive, but we do think that our customers, the amount we're paying for our customers is going to be justified by how much revenue we get from them. You, the investor with your alternative data, may be the first person to tell them, like, at this pace, you will have a monopoly. At some point, no one will be able to compete with you because your numbers are so much better. And that can be, it can be a nice way to get a pitch off on the right foot, to say, you know, if the first thing you say to someone is you literally don't know how good you are, but you're the best in the industry and we want to offer you a bunch of money. That makes people like to hear that. You know, the money part is also nice, but I think the praise matters. And that kind of data, it is very complementary to a more traditional investment process. So if you are reading the 10K and the company is talking about what was driving growth this quarter or this year, you can cross-reference that against your data. And, you know, sometimes companies, they don't like to break out some things that they're just not especially excited to rely on. So you'll sometimes have companies where they make a lot of money from, I don't know, fees that they assess on lower income customers, or they make a lot of money in ads, but a lot of the ads are for, you know, slightly dubious stuff. Like, I'm sure if Elon takes X public, he's really not going to want to talk about how much, you know, how much ad revenue they get from weed delivery services. It appears to be a whole lot, or, you know, weird gadgets of various kinds. Like, there's just a bunch of kind of dubious stuff that is a big enough chunk of the economy that it's material. Companies don't often like to talk about the more embarrassing aspects of their business, and you can measure those. And so sometimes you can kind of figure out when they say this business, they actually mean this more dubious thing that they do that is profitable, but is not something to brag about. And that can help with underwriting a short thesis. Like, let's say you're looking at a company where they do various kinds of lending, and one of the kinds of lending is payday loans, and the payday loans are very profitable, but they might get banned. If everyone knows payday loans are an issue, and you know payday loans are 17.2% of their assets and 80% of their earnings, then you know how aggressively to sell the stock when an attorney general goes after them for payday loans. So alt data, it's a really fascinating space. I think one of the things that is getting really interesting now is that we have much better tools for dealing with large volumes of unstructured text data. And it will be very interesting to see how the space evolves as the surface area of things that you can algorithmically track to know how well a company is doing gets radically expanded.
Yeah, it's interesting. So there's certainly a lot of quantitative, you know, sort of data wrangling, data aggregating, data organizing, structuring that can be done. But there's also some qualitative stuff as well. And, you know, I've been talking to some journalists recently as I'm trying to understand the media landscape better. And it's always interesting to me because what they say their skill set is finding information that no one else has that is valuable, that sort of their readers want to read, and especially ones who sell to investors or, you know, have investors targeting. If they're finding information that is guiding either investment decisions or purchasing decisions, they should just be taking a much bigger cut of the value they're creating, or they should at least be price discriminating. You know, I always go back to the example of if all of Tegas transcripts were public, it's not like they would go viral. It's not like they would have a massive audience, just the small amount of people that do read them value them very highly. So you could imagine a, you know, media company attached to some sort of investment vehicle or something that if not selling directly to investment firms, is able to trade itself. And there's some that do that on the short selling side. And that's just something, a disconnect I've seen between sort of what reporters actually do and what's the best way for them to monetize.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting economic puzzle, which like the most straightforward way to phrase it is, why is there such a thing as sell-side investment research? Like, if you are good at picking stocks, you should go to a firm that will pay you based on how well your stock picks do. And if you can't find such a firm, then maybe you're not so good after all. And I think there's some validity to that. There is at least some kind of efficient frontier. And I think that there are a couple different models you can use, one of which is there is a different skill set because equity, like sell-side equity researchers, are partly and increasingly in the business of cultivating a good relationship with management. Their buy-side clients, the ones who spend the most, one of the things that they want is one-on-one meetings with management, where they can ask more questions, get more details, or they also can benefit from group meetings with management because you, in a group meeting, you want to do a little bit of talking and a whole lot of listening to figure out what concerns everyone else has. And if everyone is looking at growth and you are the only person looking at margins and you happen to see something that is a negative surprise on margins, then you can often do very well by focusing on that, and you won't really know unless you're in the meetings. And then you won't be in the meeting if the meeting doesn't happen because the CEO of this company doesn't like the analyst who covers the stock. So sell-side analysts, they often are, they just have to be slightly on the side of management, even though they get paid by the funds, and they sort of have to contextualize things and maybe do a sort of Straussian reading where when they say that this is a bold choice, they mean this is a bad choice or something like that. Because they are like, it is actually more valuable to the end customer. So the hedge fund that's paying for research, it is more valuable for them to get research that is wrong, where they know it's wrong, but it's wrong in a way that means that they will also get the next meeting with management where they can further refine their short thesis. Like, it all ends up working out. But also so there is definitely heavy traffic from sell side to buy side. A lot of people will take a sell side investment research job as an ongoing paid audition for a buy side job. The banks understand this perfectly well. They want to have good relationships with hedge funds. A really good way to have such a relationship with a hedge fund is to have your people at that fund, and for those people to feel like, you know, they worked hard, but they did learn everything they needed to know about Excel modeling and about their industry working on the sell side. So they, you know, they're happy to steer some commissions that way as a thank you gift. But also there's some kinds of research that just don't need to be done that many times. So a company puts out a press release, they have their earnings number, a lot of people immediately open Excel and start copying numbers from the press release, putting them into the model, updating the model. Some of this has been automated, some of it hasn't, some of it's been mostly automated, but you still want a human to check it before it goes out, et cetera. And part of the function of investment research is just doing the research everybody has to do and doing it once and doing it well, or at least doing a good enough job that someone else has a starting point. So that, like, there will presumably always be a market for Excel models. You know, those might be models from DeLupa, those might be models from the investment research team at a bank, but it just doesn't make sense to always start your model with a blank sheet when somebody else has done exactly the same data entry task that you did. It can actually be a good exercise. You know, you develop a little bit more of a feel for a company just plugging all the data points in seeing how things evolved. You're doing it at a close enough pace that you do have to do a closer reading of the documents you're looking at. But if what you're trying to do is, I don't know, AT&T has just cut their CapEx budget and you have a list of publicly traded AT&T suppliers and you just want to know what the consensus revenue for all of them was and try to figure out which of them is more dependent on AT&T, like, if you're at a hedge fund, you probably just email your sales contact. You email a contact at the bank and say, please send me your most recent model for all of these companies. Or maybe there's a more efficient way to do it now. Presumably a lot of them have just a portal where you click download and get the most recent model. But yeah, that building 20 models from scratch when you're just trying to answer a pretty simple question is a huge waste. So that is the kind of thing that will get partly outsourced. And then some management teams just don't want to talk to some hedge funds, especially they don't want to talk to the hedge funds that are short. And the largest funds now are mostly market neutral, so they're as likely to be long as short. They will often spend more time talking to management or want to talk to management more when they're short. Like, you buy a company when you understand the business model and it's going well, and there's just not that much to say to the CEO then. Like, are things great or are things even greater? But if you're short, you have a lot of questions. There are a lot, and you also care a lot more about the event path. So if you're a long investor, you still have your risk limits and things, but you basically understand that if you're a long investor in a growth company, that every quarter the business you own a piece of is getting slightly more valuable. It's just continuously accumulating good things. But if you're a short seller, a short thesis, you can very reliably say, this stock is going to drop, 50 to 80% at some point in the next half decade. And the difference between having a really good track record as a short seller and being a retired former short seller is being able to figure out when that actually happens. And the more you can time and the more you can get it down to the quarter rather than the half decade, the more your short book is actually focused on the ideas that will really work. And that often does mean paying very close attention to the company, trying to figure out when they have run out of levers to pull and what move they will make that reveals to the investing public what is wrong with this model. So the hedge funds really want to talk to the companies they're short. Those companies obviously don't want to give short sellers any ammunition, don't want to talk to them. And so sometimes the way this all equilibrates is hedge fund pays a ton of money to the bank. Bank has an analyst. Analyst is really good friends with management. When they're debating, okay, who gets to fill the last seat in this meeting? And management says, I really don't want to have to deal with another obnoxious short seller yet again. Maybe the analyst calls in a favor they come to some kind of understanding and everyone gets roughly what they want, except that the company did not actually want to talk to the short sellers. So there's some managed dissatisfaction there. But I think part of what makes all of this work is ego. So CEOs do tend to think that they're doing a good job. Like, you very rarely, and my guess is very, very few CEOs wonder why more people aren't shorting their stock. Maybe a few of them do. But like, mostly, I think that is just not a question that occurs to very many of them very much of the time. So to them, it might actually feel like, you know what, if we're going to talk to someone who hates our company, we know that the company is not a hateable company. They will probably come away from this meeting feeling really jazzed up about it. And, all of the questions from the bullish analysts will utterly humiliate them. So maybe it'll all work out. So like, I think as long as the CEOs somewhat overrate their own charisma, they will underrate the risk of giving more ammunition to short sellers. And the short seller will have better information. The CEO gets to be center of attention in a meeting, which is mostly people praising his management. And so again, everyone gets a lot of what they want, but it's it's an economic system and you're competing with, you have unlimited wants and scarce, the means to satisfy those wants are scarce. So everyone has to be dissatisfied with something.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you're a data company selling to investors, another thing you have to think about is sort of, do you want to sell smart beta and put everyone at sort of be table stakes for every fund, like PitchBook in some ways is like this? I feel like Tegas is evolving this way. Or do you want to be trying to sell alpha in terms of you're not serving every fund, you're serving fewer funds and you're trying to give them an advantage? And that could be maybe you're scraping credit card data and selling it to some, or you're giving corporate access to some, where you sort of interviews with certain executives. Of course, not every company could do that. Or I feel like some of the expert networks that aren't transcript based are selling alpha, and that only some firms have access to those experts. But that's also just a consideration.
So in the long run, you just can't sell alpha. whether you are a data provider or actually a fund manager. So in the very long run, the equilibrium is that fees rise to the point where they capture all of the alpha. And so the fund is selling beta to satisfied customers who used to be making more money, and they still have made a lot of money, and now they're making less, but they understand exactly what they own. On the data provider side, you have a limited set of signals, and either those signals are getting arbed out because other people are copying your data, or those signals are getting arbed out because last quarter someone bought, you know, $50 million worth of this stock ahead of earnings. This quarter, because it worked out, they're doing 100. Next quarter, it'll be 200. At some point, the trade will be so massive that they can't do it anymore, and also because the price impact will be so big. And at that point, you have basically arbed away most of the alpha. And you've arbed away the percentage, the alpha in percentage terms, in order to maximize the customer's alpha in dollar terms. So I think, like even going back to just what is the definition of alpha? Alpha is a term in a linear regression where you take risk-free rate plus the exposure to market risk multiplied by what performance that market risk produced, and you compute... you compute an expected rate of return, like this person was 100% in equities and the S&P went up 25% last year, so they should have done 25%. And then if they actually did 30%, they added 5 points of alpha. But alpha, it's always a residual left in a linear regression that's trying to model some numbers. And the goal of the market, like the implicit goal of the market, in the same way that evolution has goals, the market has goals in that sense. And the goal is get everyone's alpha to zero as quickly as possible. So what you'll typically see is that at firms that can actually create alpha over long periods, so not just they found a good signal, but they have a good way for manufacturing new signals, and perhaps they've taken it even more meta. And so this would be like the Podshot model of you are good at manufacturing teams that are good at manufacturing signals that you can then use to make money. If you do that over time and you're able to raise your fees because you're outperforming other investments, then over time, more and more of your gains, more and more of the firm's gains go back to the founder and employees. And so over time, the firm evolves from a hedge fund to a family office or a proprietary trading firm. Like at some point, the outside investors get gradually cashed out, and what's left is internal capital that's getting a really high return. And if you're running any kind of capacity constrained strategy, at some point you evolve into a prop trader because you don't need external capital. And the external capital is extremely expensive. Like if you're getting paid 2 and 20 and you're making, you know, 50% a year on something that doesn't really scale, then the actual cost of that capital is like 12% because you're paying the actual cost of that capital is like 38%, right? Because you get 12 points of gains on that capital and you pay 38 points of gains to your outside investor. So you're actually paying more than an extremely distressed borrower, or like paying more than it would cost if you just did a cash advance on your credit card and use that to put more money into your fund. So at that point, it just doesn't make sense to have outside investors. And then the other evolution is that your alpha slowly shrinks as your AUM expands, and you end up with a large firm that in an ideal world does continuously outperform the market, but not by that much, and the fees capture most of that outperformance. So yeah, no one can really sell alpha over long periods, because if you can generate it, then eventually you don't have to sell it, and you can't necessarily generate it forever.
Do you think there will be some like people try to build like Bloomberg for private markets, or kind of these like, you know, massive what we have in the public markets, but data companies for private markets? Where do you think that analogy is interesting, or where do you think it breaks down?
Like Bloomberg would want to be the Bloomberg of private markets. Bloomberg wants to be the Bloomberg of everything, and they were. You know, I think if you've been looking at the state of financial data in the late 80s, you might have said, I want to build a Bloomberg for equities, or, you know, I want to build the Bloomberg for derivatives. Like Bloomberg was originally mostly a fixed income product, and has since expanded and continues to expand. So I think they do want to own those additional use cases. And going back to the Tiger point on people doing complementary work where their research in one area informs their decisions in another area, the more people who are doing that, the more it makes sense to have one big bundle that has all the data they could ever want for any of the various permutations of their role. And the marginal cost of delivering additional data to someone who's already a subscriber is basically zero. So your unit economics look really good if additional features reduce churn and potentially add some more seats. I do, though, I think when people look at going after Bloomberg, one of the things that they have to understand is that when Bloomberg started out, it was really good as like a tool for pricing bonds, getting quotes, things like that. And then the messaging, I'm actually not sure when they added messaging, but messaging has over time evolved into being a really crucial part of the Bloomberg ecosystem. So people get in to use the product, they stay in part because a lot of their financial industry contacts are on the terminal and that's how they reach them. So you might not want to copy that directly. And it's interesting to ask how far you could get without an internal messaging tool, or how far you get if you decided that someone else is going to win in this category of messaging. So like, I think if you were building like the Bloomberg for crypto, one of the things you'd have to say is, okay, I'm probably not going to beat Discord in terms of A, having a useful chat, and B, having the critical mass of, okay, Solana's moving. Will I find out about what rumor is driving this move in a big crypto Discord chat, or will I find out about it in this, you know, the crypto terminal? Probably you find out about it in the large general crypto chat that has way more users and way more activity. But I think there are potentially categories where Bloomberg would just, it's not big enough for Bloomberg to view it as a market they could really win. And where just the fact that they are a large organization, they have to move pretty deliberately. So I feel like maybe that's the right answer is like, if you want to start the Bloomberg of X, X has to be something you don't know about today. And you have to commit that when you discover what the next X is, something where people want data, they are making very frequent, high value decisions based on that data. They don't have enough data to make those decisions as rapidly as they want to. Like, you have to commit to, okay, I'm going to build the Bloomberg for X, and I'm going to build that faster than Bloomberg itself can launch X as a feature. So I have, 3 months, 6 months or something to get a prototype going and actually get some paying customers. So you could imagine people chipping away at Bloomberg that way. But I also, I think if I had a business like that, I would really worry about what I would lose when Bloomberg did get to feature parity with me, which they just have enough resources to do if it's worthwhile for them. And my guess is I would immediately lose the biggest, most price insensitive customers. So the large hedge funds where everyone already has a Bloomberg terminal and now they have this other terminal too. So that it's a challenging business to start. And Bloomberg did have, there was like a long period where they just had to grind. They just had to keep selling a handful of terminals to a handful of companies and keep on adding features and hope that some of their big moves, like getting into news, for example, that those would work and wouldn't be a distraction from the business. I think Bloomberg News actually, either the news service crashed or the entire terminal crashed the day that Jerry Garcia died, because it was on the terminal news feed before it was in any mainstream publication or on the TV or anything like that. And so the only way to find out if the rumor was true was to check Bloomberg News. And apparently enough people did that it got overloaded. So like I think that's a meaningful risk. Like if you pitched this to Mike Bloomberg and you gave some hypothetical scenario of what if a celebrity dies and now Bloomberg users can't trade bonds, that might actually be enough to kill the idea of Bloomberg as a news product versus just a pricing feed and chat. It did work out, but yeah, you should recognize that like there are many near possible worlds in which Mike Bloomberg was a former banker who started a tech startup and is just one more example of why it's really hard to jump from finance to tech without accidentally shooting yourself in the foot.
How critical was has the media or media part been to Bloomberg? Like, could they have done it without sort of building out this fleshed out media side, or is it basically explain a lot of the success?
I don't know. I think if stuff like Business Week and deeply reported articles in Bloomberg and money stuff, et cetera, like if those actually added a ton of like added as much value as creating additional pricing tools or something, then that would be a pretty unique situation, because usually prestige media does not pay as well as other kinds of media, and it usually trades at a premium because people want, like, the companies trade at a premium because people want to own the company. They want to own the brand name, and it's really high status. So, like, I like all of the stuff that Bloomberg puts out that is either free or at a very low cost. But my guess is that they like the liked it too, and that there's an amount they can invest in media that is less than what they do now, but is as much as is justified by here's how many incremental Bloomberg terminals will be sold if we, I don't know, send a journalist to Lebanon for a month to report on their financial crisis. Like, my guess is that actually that just doesn't, like, the numbers do not pencil out. Like, you don't actually sell an incremental terminal or two from that. And that the ad revenue certainly does not work out for sending expensive people on expensive trips to dangerous places. But it is cool to work, you know, it's cool to be an organization that can do that kind of thing, where that story would not exist if Bloomberg didn't want it to exist. And it's cool to work for such an organization. So maybe to the extent that they are, that there is a really strong economic case for doing as much content as they do, maybe the case is actually that this is a better way to retain the back end engineers who make the terminal work and keep it from crashing.
That makes sense. Segueing to a different opaque market, let's you wrote briefly about dating apps. Why don't you unpack some of your thoughts there?
Yeah, dating is a case where people, like, routinely say that the dating app market is broken. Like, very, very few people are truly happy with dating apps. And there's a selection effect there where, like, to be happy with a dating app is to have found someone and to have left the dating app. So naturally, the population that's selected for is just dissatisfied with the whole dating ordeal. So it's a business that's easy to complain about. It's really hard to figure out what you would actually change to make it better. And it's even harder to figure out, okay, if you have a dating site or dating product that is more pro-social than Tinder, so it is not people making hundreds of incredibly superficial judgments and getting in the habit of constantly rejecting almost everyone by default, but doing it in this explicit, like, you're going to swipe, you actually go out of your way to reject them. And then, you know, this sparks conversations where there's also a lot of brutal rejection, et cetera. Like, even if you come up with a better product, better for the world, better for the users, you have to answer this question of, can you build a better product that monetizes better than Tinder? And that's really hard. The business model of have a free app, cripple some features, make people pay to uncripple those features, maybe throw in some ads. Like, that's a very well-established model, and Tinder can test every permutation of that model at massive scale. So there are just very few competitors to the swipe-based apps, where if the swipe-based app decides to copy a feature and just deploy it to 1% of their users, they probably are deploying it to a larger user base than whatever this new app has total. So, you know, anything you find that's good, Tinder can copy. Anything you find that isn't good, well, there's a reason Tinder didn't copy it. So it becomes a really tough business. And people try lots of interesting things. And I do hope that people keep trying. Like, I think that the question of how people meet and who they pair up with is just a really important one. And it's a big driver of human happiness. Like, finding the right person or feeling like you can't find the right person. Like, these are very important things. People care about them a lot. So I think getting it right is really important. But maybe, you know, turning back to the media thing, like, maybe it has to be somewhat a labor of love. Like, you want to design your company around being this unkillable cockroach because you know that Tinder has better unit economics. If they think you're a real threat, they will just blanket your market with ads for their service. It will be really tough to get any market share. So you have to actually just really want it to exist, I think, to get very far building it.
My friend Devin Zugel and I are working on a dating app as a side project. And because it's not venture scale, it's or not raising money, it's just going to be a curated community. But I've always thought, it's so interesting because if you were to go around to people and say, hey, would you give 25% of your net worth to find the person of your dreams? They'd probably say, yes, of course, I'd give even higher. But then if you actually create some sort of service and ask for 25% of the net worth, they'll be very dubious and unlikely to do it. It's a thing where people value it once they have it, or they value it in the abstract in advance of having it. but there's unlikely to be a transaction, you know, a sort of service where they will give that much money because it's so illegible or not market oriented.
Yeah. And you have this weird dynamic where they will only know that they're a satisfied customer once they're in a relationship. And at that point, you don't have anything to collect. You can't be like, if you don't give me a quarter of your net worth right now, I'm taking your girlfriend back.
Yeah, exactly.
You're just like, you know, I think this is a business where the accounts receivable line will accrual of accounts receivable will significantly overstate the cash economics of the business if you actually try to capture the real value of the services. But I think it comes back to the interviewing an admin problem of if you want to get a statistically robust sample and actually know who's out there, you have to go on a lot of first dates. And if you're going for maximum information content, you have to go on a lot of bad first dates. And, you know, you will eventually learn something, but you will probably find that it's also pretty much conventional wisdom. And so you sort of wasted a lot of that opportunity cost. I think it is better to do a numbers game initially, very rapidly narrow things down, both in terms of what kind of person are you looking for, but also in terms of what are the specific people who you have been on a date or two with and have found some level of compatibility with. And, you know, as soon as you do that narrowing down process, you are escaping from the realm of market transactions and moving into something different. And at that point, trying to be the economic equivalent of the Kool-Aid man and just bursting in and saying, this is a value accretive transaction and I need my commission. doesn't appeal to anybody. So it's, I always feel bad for this because I do feel like, I guess the fact that the Tinder model of online dating is so wildly profitable and is just so, so effective at capturing attention, it does lead to negative things, but I almost view that as something closer to just a fact about the natural world. Because if that is just the local maximum that you get to if you continuously A/B test, which appears to be the case, like I met my wife on OkCupid back when OkCupid was good and it was mostly text based, and since then they seem to have always iterated in the direction of being less text based, more image focused, less desktop focused, more mobile focused, and they're not doing that just due to sabotage, you know, to ruin the fond memories of nerdy couples. They are doing that because every time they run an A/B test, the monetization gets better when they make it more like Tinder. So of course it becomes more like Tinder. And so I think the real meta question for dating, like the dating business, is, are there multiple equilibria? And then are the other equilibria actually viable in a market economy where you do have to pay to get customers and then you have to charge those customers for some service that they value and have to charge them at a point where they are willing to pay? And then the next question is, like, where can you start in the entire space of hypothetical dating sites such that your next A/B test or your next product tweak gets you closer to the good local minimum rather than getting you closer to another Tinder?
Yeah, maybe we'll have to get the CEO of OkCupid on to interview him or someone from who's running a dating app at some point. We're over time, so we'll leave it at here, and we'll cover some of the remaining topics in our next interview. Bern, always a pleasure. Thanks for this.
Thanks for listening to The Riff. Please go follow and subscribe, give us 5 stars, and check out Bern's excellent newsletter, The Diff, if you haven't already.